a case report on delayed respiratory arrest in a patient following interscalene block. This case report has an overview of complications associated with interscalene approach to brachial plexus block. Introduction. Interscalene approach to the brachial plexus is the most proximal approach to brachial plexus and is utilized commonly for procedures performed on or near the shoulder joint and arm. This method of regional anesthesia saves the patient from pain, nausea and vomiting, which are associated with general anesthesia. Although interscalene approach to brachial plexus block is quite safe, a wide variety of complications have been reported with it. We report a case where a 56-year-old lady with flare chest and shoulder injury that was undergoing a surgical toilet and debridement with application of external fixator on left humerus upper shaft involving left shoulder joint under interscalene block. The patient landed in cardiorespiratory arrest about half an hour in the procedure and nearly 50 minutes after the block was administered. Case report. A 56-year-old female, 156 centimeters tall, weighing 56 kilograms, with ASA, that is American Society of Anesthesiologists, status 3, was admitted to the hospital after having met with a road traffic accident. The patient was a known case of chronic obstructive airway disease, that is COAD, had a chest injury with fracture of ribs 4 to 8 on the left side and leading to a flailed segment on the left side and a compound fracture of the upper one-third humerus extending to involve the left shoulder joint. The patient was examined, investigated and excluded for any pneumothorax. Chest x-ray had signs of COAD and fracture 4 to 8 ribs left side and was otherwise unremarkable. The patient had a breath holding time of 20 seconds. No other systematic abnormality was documented on history and examination and investigations otherwise were in the normal limit. In view of the respiratory status and chest injury to patient, it was decided to perform the surgery under interscalene approach to brachial plexus block. Before starting with the procedure, the patient was examined by a thoracic surgeon who advised strapping of the flailed segment during the perioperative period. Accordingly, flailed segment was strapped before taking up the patient. The patient was placed supine with neck turned to the other side. Block was performed using 21G 25mm needle. The needle was introduced on the left side in the interscalene groove at the level of cricoid cartilage. After eliciting paresthesia and negative aspiration, block was induced with 20 mL of 2% lignocaine with 1:200,000 epinephrine and 20 mL of 0.5% of bupivacaine with negative aspiration performed initially and at every 10 mL in between. Pain experienced by the patient gradually abolished. Adequacy of sensory effect was tested by pinprick after 20 minutes and was found to be adequate. The patient was provided oxygen by nasal cannula at 3 lpm and injection midazolam 2 mg IV. At this point, the surgical team was allowed to proceed with the procedure. After about 20 minutes in the procedure, it was noticed that the patient's voice had diminished in intensity, and over the next 10 minutes, the patient gradually landed in aphonia. Respiration and other vital parameters were normal till this time. About 5 minutes later, the patient suddenly landed in apnea and her heart rate started decreasing and she became unconscious. The patient was given injection atropine 0.6 mg IV and intubated immediately and positive pressure ventilation was instituted. Patient's heart rates rose and settled in the normal range of the remainder of the procedure. The patient was ventilated with 100% oxygen initially for 20 minutes and then with O2N2O in a 1:1 ratio. Her vital signs remained stable otherwise throughout the rest of the surgery. No further arrhythmia was documented. Additional midazolam 2 mg IV was provided with intubation. Patient's spontaneous respiratory efforts resurfaced over the next 30 minutes and from then onwards, the patient's respiration was assisted. In the next 30 minutes, the patient had sufficient respiratory efforts to maintain the ventilation and was left on spontaneous ventilation on AIRS 2Ps with O2 at 4 lpm. By the time the surgical procedure was finished, the patient was awake and fully following verbal commands and was extubated. Detailed examination of the patient in post-operative and a day later failed to reveal any persistent neurological deficit and the patient was discharged after 7 days. The discussion. Shoulder procedures associated with severe pain. Interscalene brachial plexus block is an effective and reliable method of providing anesthesia with a persistent effect providing for some post-operative pain relief. Further, the technique is free from other side effects associated with general anesthesia and also provides for good operating conditions with reduced blood loss, excellent muscle relaxation, reduced cost of treatment, etc. The performance of interscalene block with a standard technique and drug application is associated with a high success rate and with very few long-term complications. The major acute complication / side effects associated with interscalene block are respiratory depression due to associated ipsilateral phrenic block, intravascular injection that may lead to seizure and cardiac arrest, pneumothorax, epidural and spinal anesthesia, Horner's syndrome that is ipsilateral cervical sympathetic block, and hoarseness and dysphagia that is ipsilateral recurrent laryngeal nerve block. The case we described was of a young elderly lady with coexisting COAD and a flail segment. The patient required an urgent surgical intervention as she had compound fracture with intra-articular extension. Because of the respiratory status and coexisting flail segment in the patient, we wished to avoid general anesthesia in her. Only interscalene approach to brachial plexus was suitable for her, as the surgery involved working on and in close proximity with the shoulder joint. The performance of block was easy as described by Winnie's technique, and the sensory block was well established in the expected time. The surgery progressed well in the initial state without any problem. However, after 40 minutes, the problem started progressing to the extent where respiratory assistance was required. Subsequently, after another 30 minutes, spontaneous respiratory efforts were evident again and sufficient strength was restored over the next 30 minutes. Subsequently, the patient had complete recovery without any residual deficit. The course of events in this case suggests delayed migration of local anesthetic agent in the central neural space. However, whether the extension was into the extradural or subarachnoid space would not be commented on with certainty. The central migration of the local anesthetic agents in interscalene block is a known entity, and though infrequently seen, cases have been documented in this regard. However, it usually occurs much earlier than in the case discussed. Also in the literature available, no case report had coexistent acute chest injury. Further, the temporary strapping performed beforehand did not provide the cover during assisted respiration. Central neuraxial anesthesia has been reported as the complication of interscalene block despite locating the brachial plexus easily with paresthesia. This has usually been characterized by the fall of blood pressure and heart rate, extension of sensory and motor block outside the dermatomes expected for interscalene block with or without involvement of the phrenic nerves. The patient may or may not retain the consciousness. The complication can present after interscalene block at varied time intervals immediately following block to those delayed by up to 1 hour. The central migration of drug can be the spinal, epidural or subdural space, and indeed it may be difficult to identify the exact cause for the complication. However, the subdural spread can be suspected, and the spread of block outside the brachial plexus is much patchy in distribution and is associated with minimal sympathetic block, and the interval between the initial block and onset of symptoms is too long. Spinal and epidural spreads are associated with relatively denser block with more profound sympathetic block. The motor component of the block is more in case of spinal spread. The central neuraxial block can occur as a result of direct deposition of drug in the central neuraxial space in spinal, epidural or subdural space. It can occur because of faulty technique, with the needle being directed more anteriorly. Even with correct direction, the needle may pass directly through the intervertebral foramen into either of the central neuraxial space, especially when probing for brachial plexus in the depth. At times, sudden movement by the patient during placement of block may redirect the needle and alter the tissue relationship, and the drug is then deposited directly in the central neuraxial space. In this scenario, the central neuraxial block usually occurs immediately after the performance of block when the drug goes subarachnoid space, or after a few minutes in the case of cervical epidural spread. Apart from time of onset, the degree and spread of sympathetic and motor block are also more in case of spinal than epidural spread of drug. Alternatively, the block may be correctly placed in interscalene space, but the drug may spread into the central neuraxial space via a rent created in dura formed during the performance of the block, or along the perineural space following an intraneural injection. Or the drug may also track proximally after an intraneural injection through the nerves, dissecting neural fascicles into the subarachnoid space or in the substance of the spinal cord. Subsequent to migration of drug in the cellular axis space, the patient may become apneic and require respiratory assistance. The requirement to induce of general anesthesia depends on the effect of consciousness and the ability to intubate. The patient usually requires ventilation for the time period of the motor block. The consciousness may return earlier than the recovery of motor function, in which case supplementary sedation may be required in later stages. However, at times the phrenics may escape the central neuraxial extension of the block. In this case, the patient may keep on breathing spontaneously despite a high spinal and should be carefully observed for the respiratory status. This complication may be associated with significant effect on hemodynamics ranging from profound fall of blood pressure to bradycardia and cardiac arrest, which should be actively sought for and aggressively managed accordingly. These patients may subsequently develop a headache similar to postdural puncture headache in characteristics, providing a further clue to the likely mechanism of the phenomenon. Use of in-situ catheter for continuation of interscalene block in post-operative period for provision of analgesia can also be complicated by migration of catheter in the central neuraxial space, causing high spinal or epidural blockhead with its use. This is especially when the catheter is inserted too deep in the space and with blind placement of catheter. Therefore, aids to resuscitation should always be at hand, for even 1 ml of 1% lignocaine can lead to bilateral phrenic involvement. When the central neuraxial block occurs as a result of intraneural injection or direct intrathecal injection, the course is further complicated by the possibility of persisting neurological damage because of the neural injury suffered. Further, as the intraneural injection is very painful, it provides good safety margin against this complication when the block is performed in an awake patient. However, if the block is performed in a patient under general anesthesia under deep sedation, this safety margin is lost. Deep sedation may indeed aggravate the injury on account of an unpredictable response under sedation. It has been suggested that the distance from skin to subarachnoid space may get as short as 2 inches during performance of interscalene block. Further, as interscalene block is a relatively superficial block, most of the complications occur when a deeper placement is attempted. The use of a smaller needle of 1 to 1.5 inches in size may provide some protection against accidental direct subarachnoid injection. The emergence of nerve stimulator and ultrasound guidance had made performing the regional blocks easier and more successful, and anesthetists need not depend upon eliciting the paresthesia for performing the block. However, with it has come the hazard of performing the block under deeper sedation or general anesthesia, whereby the chances of neural injury as a result of placement of intraneural injection have increased. Though it is useful in locating the nerves, a nerve stimulator does not distinguish an intraneural form, a perineural needle position. Use of ultrasound assistance may help in avoiding the neural injury, as the needle insertion usually is some distance away from nerves and the intraneural injection can be visualized. However, the technique is operator dependent and requires use of ultrasonogram, which may not be available at all locations. Interscalene block almost always involves the ipsilateral phrenic nerve, leading to hemiparesis of diaphragm, which can be documented as de novo flattening of ipsilateral hemidiaphragm on a chest X-ray. Further, this involvement of phrenic is independent of the amount of drugs used and cannot be prevented by procedures like manual application of pressure above the injection site to prevent proximal spread of drug. It is now presumed to be due to the rostral spread of drug to involve 3 to 5 nerve roots. Spread of local anesthetic agent along the anterior surface of scalene muscle can also play a part in this. The paresis may occur within 5 minutes of performing the block and may last up to 9 hours in case of a longer acting agent. This may cause up to 25% reduction in the pulmonary function. Most of the hemiparesis goes unrecognized because of lack of complaint of any symptom in the patients who have no underlying lung disease. However, in patients with severe respiratory involvement, this may cause respiratory distress and discomfort to the extent that artificial ventilation may be needed. Rarely, the patient may land in apnea following an otherwise perfectly located brachial plexus even with the help of a nerve stimulator. The irritation of phrenic nerve by needle may result in reflex paresthesia in shoulder region while the plexus lies posterior to the side. This aspect should always be guarded against, and any paresthesia localized to shoulder should be interpreted with caution. Further, while using nerve stimulator, the patient's forearm is resting on abdomen, then sudden contraction of diaphragm due to neural stimulation may be misinterpreted as a contraction of arm muscles, and hence ideally the arm and forearm should be by the side of the body so as to minimize this risk. Horner's syndrome due to involvement of stellate ganglion occurs frequently with interscalene block. This is due to the close relationship of stellate ganglion with the brachial plexus at the site of the block. However, it does not cause much problem and usually recovers after the effect of block wears off. With interscalene block, the ipsilateral recurrent laryngeal nerve may be involved in the block. This may cause some hoarseness of voice usually and no further trouble. However, in patients with prior affection and paresis of the contralateral vocal cord, there may occur severe stridor and respiratory compromise, and hence before giving interscalene block, the patient should always be examined preoperatively for the status of vocal cord function, preferably with indirect laryngoscopy, and any past history of hoarse voice or thyroid or neck surgery should be carefully inquired into to avoid this complication. These patients should be specifically evaluated for this aspect in the preoperative assessment. If there is any suspicion, then they should undergo proper ENT evaluation. Rarely, manipulations during performance of an interscalene block and increased flow in blood vessels to the blocked extremity can lead to a thromboembolic episode, especially in patients predisposed to it. This group of patients include those who had a central venous catheter on the side, pacemaker and malignancy, and those who are receiving concurrent therapy for lower limb deep vein thrombosis. This thromboembolic phenomenon can cause a sudden onset hypoxia in these patients. One case of a persisting brachial plexus block lasting for more than 18 months has also been reported. This could have occurred as a result of direct traumatization of the plexus during block or operation, or due to the toxicity of injected bupivacaine, distension of plexus or cervical syndrome, or aseptic plexitis. However, the pattern of lesion and lack of pain during localization and injection suggest towards a traumatization during surgery. Intravascular injection of local anesthetic agent may occur, especially when the needle direction is anterior, as it may enter the vertebral artery, and then the injection of local anesthetic will lead to immediate convulsions even with newer relatively safe drugs. An inadvertent intravascular injection may occur despite a negative aspiration test and negative result for a test dose, as in the case of injection of drug in a minor vein or due to intravascular migration of drug, leading to toxicity of local anesthetic agent. So wherever possible, ideally, one should go for an incremental injection technique with sufficient time delay allowed between the doses so as to avoid this potential hazard, even with safer new drugs. There has been a single report of Tapia's syndrome, ipsilateral palsy of 10th and 12th cranial nerve associated with interscalene block, which was diagnosed later as the hoarseness, and Horner's syndrome, which are relatively commonly seen during interscalene block. It has been suggested that if a patient develops hoarseness with performance of interscalene block, he or she should be examined for tongue protrusion and deviation. In case these are present, the procedure should be abandoned and the patient subjected to carotid angiography for need of anticoagulation, as the condition may arise as a result of spontaneous dissection of carotid artery, especially in males in their 40s. Close proximity of brachial plexus to the vertebral artery, the jugular veins, and carotid and subclavian vessels may result in injury to these vessels and in hematoma formation. Fortunately, it's not very common. Pneumothorax is one of the dreaded complications of brachial plexus block by supraclavicular approach. However, the incidence is much less with interscalene block. There has been an overall reduction in the incidence of pneumothorax to the point where it has now become a rare complication, that is only 0.2%, which can be attributed to the improvement in technique and needles now used for the block. Quite a few patients undergo shoulder surgery in semi-sitting or sitting posture. They may experience sudden bradycardia and hypotension, sometimes progressing to cardiac arrest. There is some evidence that this may be due to Bezold Jarisch reflex, which occurs due to the combination of reduced ventricular volume and a hypercontractile ventricle secondary to sympathetic stimulation. It can be prevented by providing anxiolytics, intravenous fluids and metoprolol or other beta blockers. The best preventive measure for this catastrophe are vigilance and prompt treatment of bradycardia, hypertension and anxiety. Nerve injury sustained during brachial plexus block is a recognized complication, but apart from neural injury sustained during performance of block, other factors like position of patient during block and surgery and surgical injury may also be involved. Though pain, dysesthesia, paresthesia, etc. are commonly reported after surgery with brachial plexus block, few persist for long term and they usually resolve spontaneously. There is no complication associated with the use of catheter. However, diagnosis of sulcus ulnaris syndrome and carpal tunnel syndrome must be excluded in case of persisting paresthesia. Oldman et al. Reported that a shoulder surgery performed under general anesthesia resulted in a complication of pneumothorax in the post-operative period. They further stated that if the surgery had been performed under brachial plexus block, the occurrence of pneumothorax could easily have been blamed on regional anesthesia. Hence, one should be wise and rational in ascribing any complication in the post-operative period to regional anesthetic technique. This certainly does not mean that regional anesthesia is absolutely free of complication. On the contrary, it has its own share of complications and side effects which should be accounted for, but not everything is always due to it. Conclusion. We are all aware that no procedure is absolutely safe and adequate for all patients, and interscaling approach to brachial plexus block is no exception from this rule. However, if following precautions are observed while performing interscaling block, then the complications associated with it can be minimized. 1. Always perform the block on an awake patient or patient under very light sedation. 2. Any increase in pain, especially severe pain, should warn the anesthetist of an intraneural injection and the adjustment in needle position should be made accordingly. 3. Avoid performing the block in an uncomfortable, non-cooperative patient. General anesthesia can be the alternative anesthetic technique in these patients, and then other approaches for post-operative analgesia can be adopted. 4. Always use a short bevelled needle, 25 to 35 mm in size, as most of the complications associated with block are encountered when one probes deeper for locating the brachial plexus. 5. Needle should be entered in the interscaling groove with the posterior inferior direction. 6. An interscaling block is a superficial block. Inability to localize brachial plexus at 1 to 1.5 inches should prompt one that the needle may be in wrong plane and one should withdraw and re-enter rather than going more deep. 7. Each patient before undergoing interscaling block must be evaluated for the status of contralateral phrenic and recurrent laryngeal nerve function and if suspected should have a proper ENT examination. 8. Successful initiation of block and surgery does not guarantee outcome as late complications can occur and constant vigilance and management of respiratory and circulatory systems are mandatory. 9. There should be greater education and training for the nerve blocks to the trainee anesthetist so that the person's experience in its performance are doing it because complications are less in informed and experienced hands. 10. The greater use of ultrasonography guidance may further increase the safety of the procedure. And 11. The physician should ensure that the patient does not move unexpectedly during the procedure and be prepared for it.